are listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Hi, this is Meg Riley in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You've joined us for another episode of The View. Today we have Lori Stone-Sertoski standing in for Jessica Star Rocker as Jessica is in class at Meadville Lombard. We also have Aisha Hauser and Christina Rivera are at Finding Our Way Home. So Michael and I are still here. Michael, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Meg. This is Michael Tino joining you from Peekskill, New York, where the snow is melting and we have electricity flowing to my house. So
You were out last week because of absence of electricity.
We had two storms here, both of which knocked out power to my house, one for 3 days and one for one. I'm just very grateful that it got restored so quickly. And it helped at least at the beginning of those 3 days to think about the people in Puerto Rico who are still without power and might not get it back before May. That ceased to help when the house was 41 degrees, but luckily we're back and my kid's back in school. And
did you stay there when your house was 41 degrees?
We did. We spent one night at a hotel, but hotels are expensive, especially when a million people are without power and they all want to go to hotels. So the night before I had to preach, we all stayed at a hotel. Well, other than that, yes, we did. I didn't get much sleep that last night when it was so very cold.
Yeah. You know, seeing all the people on Facebook who have been without power, I think of the people with sustained power loss in Puerto Rico. It's still a large percent of the population there that's without any power. And it's...
Yeah, and I have a friend who lives in the U.S. Virgin Islands on St. John who lost power for 4 months after Irma hit there. And she still, the power goes in and out. There are days that she has no electricity and they have generators at the ready to charge up phones and keep connected to the world. But it's become a way of life that they don't know on any given day if they'll have electricity.
And for many people around the world, that's their daily occurrence. And we get so used to being able to just flick that switch and have things work for us that it's hard to recall that.
Indeed.
And that's Lisa Presley piping up. Lisa is the Congregational Life Consultant of the Mid-America region and our guest for today. She's going to talk about some research that she did on sabbatical about how grief impacts leadership of religious leaders. But before we get to that, let's just take a moment to celebrate all those students yesterday, because that just was, for me, a great and much needed jolt in the arm, and just deep gratitude for all of the leadership that went into that in hundreds and hundreds of local areas. I know here, the little elementary school down the block that's just K-3, invited all the adults in the area to just come down and surround the school, you know, and they didn't walk out. The 3-8 did up the street, but the K-2, I guess, they stayed in. But yeah, I was moved by that they reached out to all the neighbors about it. And lots of us went. It was, you know, 17 minutes of neighborly silence.
No, thanks. I was yesterday, I was at a conference here called Pride Works, which is a countywide conference for LGBTQ youth. And there were about 500 LGBTQ youth there. And the keynote speaker was speaking at the 10 o'clock hour. And she paused and noted. She's like, you are doing something here that is subversive and empowering. And like, you've walked out of school, but we're going to recognize that this is the time when your peers are walking out of school for this reason. It was very powerful. It was also powerful to be in this amazing queer youth space when that happened. We didn't all go outside, but you know, it was a college gym full of queer youth. Just amazing space to be in when that was happening all over the country.
Lori and Lisa, how about you? Lori, how about where you are? You're still in Indiana, I know.
That's right. For the next 8 days, I'll be in Indianapolis, Indiana. We had several schools that engaged in the walk out, including George Washington High School, which is in the Indianapolis Public School District. And I did have some photographs posted from a friend of mine who's a teacher there. And she said that she's also an organizer. She was an organizer with Freedom Indiana that helped to fight the RFRA bills that came here in Indiana a couple years ago when Mike Pence was still our governor. And so she was like carrying the bullhorn then. And now she followed the students' lead and did everything they requested during the protest. So it was very good modeling for how adults should be getting out of the way rather than doing some kind of counter movement, that walk up, not walk out movement that I've seen has been really frustrating for me. Have people heard about that?
Yeah, it's like victim blaming. It's really pretty awful.
Yeah, what I've seen is some adults have taken over some of the imagery of the walkout movement that the youth created to fight to raise awareness about gun violence in schools, particularly, and saying, no, instead of walking out this day, you should walk up to that student sitting alone in the cafeteria. You should walk up to the person who never seems to have a partner in the gym activities. Like somehow, yeah, it's the other student's fault that these folks, end up committing gun violence. And it's like, well, you're misplacing the blame there for sure.
Lisa, how about where you are?
Well, I haven't seen the newspaper yet to see how it happened yesterday. I don't live close enough to any schools to have observed them. But one of the things I saw online, and I'm so sorry, I didn't remember the young man's name or his location, but there was one young gentleman whose school did have a walkout, but he did the research before that day to find out how many young people have been killed by school violence. And he ended up staying out a minute for every student. He was sitting by himself outside the school for 3 hours and 42 minutes. And just
kids have been there. Since when? Because
yeah, I can't remember when, but he did the research. But that's, 180, 222, if I'm doing my math correctly. Mm-hmm. And his courage at doing that and doing the research and staying there by himself. He didn't join the others during the 17 minutes. He just went, and I think he sat at the base of a flagpole, the American flagpole, and just sat there in silent witness for those 3 hours and 42 minutes.
Interesting. Yeah, I was really moved by the school where they were forbidden to walk out, and the young Latina walked out by herself, knowing that she would be suspended for it. I also read of schools where they had to choose their punishment for doing it, and some kids chose corporal punishment, which I didn't even know was legal in schools anymore. So, you're really seeing the gamut of what the schools are like from this and from their responses to it. In the liberal cities, it's like, yeah, we support you. And in some other areas, it's much riskier. Michael, sorry, I was interrupting you.
No, I just, I think that it's important to note that that young person that Lisa refers to only set out a minute for every kid killed in school, which is scary enough. But if he'd been out there for every child killed by gun violence, he would have been at the flagpole for 14,000 minutes, right? So,
right.
And that's like the last 20 years or something.
Yeah, those shoes on the White House lawn are very powerful. I think there's 7,000 pairs of those. I was thinking as a parent what it would be like to have your dead child's shoes and to put them there. We who are parents, like me, it's just, well, it's. I mean, anybody who loves children, it's just beyond, it's beyond imagination what life would go on to be.
Right, and it takes me back to the AIDS epidemic. where there were parents who would have not even wanted to put their child's shoes out to let them know. And, you know, that epidemic, thankfully, has been cured for the most part in our country, not necessarily everywhere else, but, you know, now with access to, for many people, not all, to medication, you know, that has mitigated against that. But I'm sure hoping we can find a way to take some kind of mitigating steps to reduce the epidemic of gun violence and to make sure that that isn't, you know, that we can at least be at least as successful as we have with HIV and AIDS in our country and, you know, and that kind of thing. So it's very interesting to see which epidemics get recognized as such and get treated as such and get the money thrown at them to be able to make the difference.
Yeah, and we'll say again that had Black students walked out in protest of police killings of their friends, very few school districts, even in the liberal cities, would have been of support, certainly here. Yesterday, I posted a thing that the former mayor wrote, encouraging public officials who are scared to love the kids. And it was moving to me because she didn't handle the protests well here at all. She really didn't. She was horrible, actually. I voted against her and she didn't get reelected. Progressives didn't vote for her. But she was acknowledging that she made mistakes, she was scared, and that she overwhelmingly eventually realized that she loved the kids more than she was afraid and encouraged other public officials to go with love and not fear. And I was moved that she acknowledged that she blew it and that she continues to learn and that she encouraged other public officials to learn a little faster and learn from what she did. So life goes on. Well, speaking of grief, we are speaking of grief today. Lisa Presley, as the Congregational Life Consultant of the Mid-America Region, has watched a lot of negotiated settlements in her tenure and I think was inspired by that to do some research on sabbatical about how grief figured into that. So Lisa, I'm curious, you must have seen something that made you think that was an important piece of negotiated settlements, that ministers were in grief about something. Or I don't know if we're talking just about ministers or all religious professionals.
Well, because of my experience has been primarily with ministers, it did focus on that. I realized at the end of this that I wish that I could interest somebody else in picking this up for either a doctor of ministry or PhD research or somebody who has funding to be able to do that, because it was really very compelling. But what happened for me was a number of years ago, one of the things we do as Congregational Life staff for the UUA is anytime there's a ministerial transition, we do an exit interview with the minister and a transition interview with the congregation's board, just to get a snapshot of how things are, of what went on, etc. And one of the things that I realized that year was I had done three sets of interviews for ministers who had had a negotiated resignation or a pressured termination, or in one way or another were leaving, not because they decided it was time for them to go, but because of some upheaval in the congregation. And in each one of those cases, the ministers had experienced deep personal loss 2 or 3 years before the ending of their ministry. There had either been a divorce, or there had been the death of a partner, or there had been, the one was trying to adopt a child and that fell through. But there was really deep personal grief. And so that got me thinking about what is it about how ministers face grief, about our congregational expectations around ministers and grief, and how might we be able to step in earlier to support the ministers and the congregations in these situations?
It's really interesting. So you saw that it was usually 2 or 3 years before.
Right. So what I did, my methodology was, I used social media and said, hey, I'm doing this survey on the impact of personal grief. And we know that ministers and other religious professionals as well, it's not just ministers, but religious educators, music people, anyone who does ministry as their paid job in the congregation or their professional job, whether paid or not, they feel the impact of all the things that happen to members of the congregation and within the congregation. And yet, because of their professional stance, they need to remain sort of a step removed from the congregation. It's the minister's job, the religious professional's job, to deal with their own stuff outside of the congregation so as not to blur the appropriate boundaries that need to be there. Certainly, the religious professionals have to be in deep, genuine relationship, but we don't do our own personal, emotional work on the congregation. So I sent out this survey and said, hey, tell me about what you've done. And I got probably about 30, 35 responses. And then I entered into hour-long conversations with the people who were willing from that group. One of the things I was hoping to be able to prove was that it wasn't just coincidence, but there was a correlation between the minister's grief and the negotiated resignation. I wasn't able to do that because I didn't have very many people who fit that category who came forward. And it struck me there are a lot of reasons. One, you don't want to have to admit that this happened to you. They might not be on social media. It might still be too tender for them. Understandably, the ministry staff group can't tell me who has had those kinds of endings so that I could reach out to them. So I was somewhat limited in who I talked with. But I still got enough information that I could show that there is a real deep difference in impact. One of the things that is true about any ministry position, whether it be the fellowship to minister, the religious educator, the music director, whatever, is that those positions are often more about how you are in relationship with the people than whether or not you can do the job. Now, yes, some religious educator or music director positions might be only administrative and not ministerial, but for any of those that do include ministry to their teachers or the families or the whatever, it's not, do you have the curriculum ready? Do you have the sermon prepared? It's how are you able to be in genuine, deep relationship with me? Do you love me the way I am while you're still urging me to be someone different? And so it's very different than in a lot of other jobs where going to work can often be an escape from your personal life and your connection, where you can shelve the emotional part of yourself and just do the job. I've had lots of jobs like that before myself, but it's about that connection. And so what grief does is it in some ways totally immobilizes our usual way of being. It confounds our own emotional sense. So we're not able to be present in the same way with people as we have been able to be previously. Most corporate world gives you maybe 3 days off for a death, or if you're lucky, 5 days off. And that's sort of what people are used to. And the deep impact of grief can be felt by many people in their work lives without disrupting the work life as much as it can in ministry, where you're having to make that deep emotional commitment and connection with people.
Yeah, I'm interested. I mean, and I hear you saying you didn't get enough results to be conclusive about anything, but I don't think there are, at least in my experience, those stages of grief are very loose guidelines for the way right. that things evolve. But, that the beginning, I think particularly I would think for people with marginalized identities or who are real introverts, either one, there would just be a whole lot of need for privacy right at the beginning of grief, which churches might feel as rejection in some kind of way, right? That churches, yep. I can imagine congregations, we'll grieve with you. And people for a variety of reasons saying, no, thank you very much. I need privacy for this. It's deeply personal to me. And that could create some rifts. I wonder.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that all the ministers said is they did not feel as if they returned anywhere to near normal or near a new normal for them for a minimum of 6 months afterwards. They felt as if they couldn't really make that deep connection. But it was also interesting. They felt that they could make a deeper connection with people who had suffered a similar loss. So that there was, because there was a recognition there. That was obvious, that we both have been through this. We understand what's going on, even though we know it's different from you. But there was this sense of not being able to be emotionally fluent during that time, and not being able to pay attention to the same level of details or fulfill the same level of needs. And trust me, when you are grieving the loss of a partner, what color cup the membership committee should give visitors has very low priority in your emotional bandwidth. Now that's a somewhat silly example, but I've been in too many of those conversations to know. And so there was a sense of distance. And for ministers who were relatively new in their congregations, that sense of distance during that initial bonding period really was a difficult thing. That's what happened with me when my father died 5 weeks into my first settled ministry. I realized I wasn't able to connect with people in the same way. And yes, there are people's desires to help and do that. And there was also a great deal of impatience. That happened 2 weeks ago. You should be over that by now because of how our society treats death and grief. And you know, there are also some losses that ministers just would never own up to. I talked to ministers who either they or their partner had lost a child they were carrying, had miscarried. They did not want to share that with the congregation, and yet the congregation didn't always understand what was going on. And what happens in cases where there was some dis-ease in the relationship before the grief incident, there was almost a sense of sharks in the water. Going, you know, they could sense the vulnerability of the minister. And so any conflicts that had existed before, they were exacerbated by this. And people took advantage of the fact that the minister was distracted. And ministers also said they didn't notice political things that were happening in the church because of the distraction of their grief, which is a bizarre way to name grief.
You know, it's interesting. There are lots of factors you've mentioned. And as a minister, there's a really basic tension, I think, that you're talking about, right? So there's this tension between we want you to be authentic and not that authentic, right? Like, we want you to be, like, authentically who you are, but still have healthy boundaries.
Right.
So, if you're authentically grieving, the natural inclination of people who care about you is to want to take care of you. And as ministers, right, that's a boundary.
Yes.
And a healthy one, right? Our congregation should not be taking care of us, is what we're taught again and again. It's fascinating to me. And I'm wondering, Lisa, if you've seen people who've done this better.
Yes. Yes, I have.
What does that look like?
Well, one of the things that I asked the ministers about was how much time did you take away? And there was a real difference. There were people who didn't take any time. There were people who did take time. Part of this also depended how long they had been in the congregation. Some of the ministers who had been in their congregations 5 or 6 years, who had very deep relationships, could say readily and easily to their boards, "I need time off." And the boards and congregations that gave the ministers time off, whether it be in the immediate aftermath of the death, or, you know, somewhere down the road, they those ministries ended up going very well. And the congregation had deeper, you know, the deep respect and the trust was there. One of the things I want to play with, though, is your use of the word authentic as opposed to the word genuine. So I was at the Ministers Institute in January, where Deborah Pope Lance, who has done a lot of work around coaching ministers and how to work with congregations, started talking about the difference. And then I went off on flights that I can't blame on Deborah. So, you know, being authentic is something that we do inside ourselves, and it is only about us. Whereas being genuine is something we can only do in relationship. And so what I think congregations want is a minister who is genuine with them rather than authentic. As someone said, well, you can be an authentic SOB. That might be who you really are authentically, but that doesn't lead to genuine relationship in congregations. And so I've now started looking at that genuineness. And so, and yes, there are still boundaries on what a minister can be able to share and allow for healthy boundaries and division within the congregation. So those who were able to take time off, who either could ask for it or had that sense of it, ended up faring better, and especially the congregations that allowed that. It was fascinating because one of the ministers I talked with did not ask for any time off for themselves. But when their director of religious education had a loss sometime a couple months later, asked for and went to the floor with the board to say, we need to give this person 10 days off, you know, but never felt they could do that for themselves. Another minister who developed cancer, you know, had read all the good books about, you know, well, the way that you survive something like this is that you keep things as normal as possible. And so they did their chemotherapy on their day off every week so as not to miss any work. And over a 2-year battle with cancer, I think only missed 2 weeks, which stunned me, surprised me, and I wondered how much processing time they were able to get. But, you know, there's difference between the introversion way and the extroversion way as well, and what we share.
Well, and there's, to me, you know, that, so I'll use the word genuineness because you've made that distinction. There's a way in which our genuineness in relationship with our congregations also models things,
yes,
for them. And so, you know, I've certainly had difficult moments as a new parent. For example, I realized that I could not actually be a good parent and be a good minister at the same time. And, you know, and I sort of broke down to the congregation. I said, listen, my kid's going to win, right? Yeah. You lose. If we put those things in competition with one another, you lose. So let's find a way not to put those things in competition with one another.
And Michael, you've been there. How many years had you been there when you adopted Nora?
Well, she'll be 5 in June. So, and I'll have been there 11 years in June. Yeah.
So you were in deep relationship with them. I mean,
I was.
Lisa's saying that, you know, I feel like my board would support whatever I needed. Now, that would have been much harder when I was brand new to ask for it and probably for them to trust me with it. I mean, I think, you know, I'm remembering when my mother died, the UUA where I worked at the time said, yeah, go be with her. It's really important. And I spent the last 3 weeks of her life taking care of her and barely doing a thing for work. My brother, who works in the corporate world and makes a million times more money than I do, was told if he didn't go to a conference in California, which was right when they said she would die, that he would be fired. And so if he were on a church board, he would bring that pain of his own experience with grief and the way that it wasn't respected into any decision. Hopefully it would make him more compassionate. But, you know, I say this having worked in the DC area, noticing how, and this was a while ago, I can't even imagine what it would be now, but the government workers were being treated so badly And I noticed them treating the ministers badly. And I thought it was because they thought, why should you get all this stuff when I have, you know, my own work life sucks so much and you want a sabbatical? What? And so I think this sort of, in a way, brings to a boil the whole culture's dysfunction around grief and death, you know, because even though you can say, you know, in some jobs, it really doesn't impact you as much. Really? I mean, if people could be human, I mean, you know, ministers have to be human. That's our job, is to be, what's our word? It's not authentic. It's
genuine.
Genuine. Okay. Yeah. This is new to me, so I'll go along with it. Doesn't mean anything yet, but I'll go along with it. But so that's part of what we're supposed to be, you know, but there's nobody who can suffer a major grief, no matter whether they're computer programmer or whatever they're doing, it's going to impact every cell of their body. I mean, that's what grief does. It just eats you alive.
Yes, it does. And as someone who used to do bookkeeping as my profession, I could escape into that work sometimes and forget what was going on. There's very little in ministry that is escape. You can't find the distraction in the work because the distraction is often other people's grief and pain and broken dreams. You know, the number of times that I got called when I was in the parish, or the number of times I get called now that I work as congregational life staff for somebody to share their joy with me, I can probably count on, you know, 10 fingers and have fingers left over. People come with their grief and their broken dreams. And so that's what they come with. Now, some of the things that, you know, that I did write a paper on this, and I've given a copy to the Ministers Association, executive directors and other people, you know, the UUA ministry staff. One of the things I'm delighted to say is the UUA is in the process of working with the Ministers Association to put out a new joint recommendation draft letter of agreement for ministers. And in it, they include bereavement leave as a stated category, which they wouldn't have done before. So that felt really good. But I think there's work for our UUMA chapters. How do they support their colleagues? Do they offer to go and preach? Do they provide the same kind of sort of sabbatical kind of coverage of the pulpit to help out? How can our retired clergy help out by coming in and preaching for a few weeks to allow ministers to escape and to have that time? You know, so those are some of the suggestions that I think would be really helpful. One of the other ministers I talked to has said that what in his experience, what was really important was all the work that he had done early on about what was his theology of death, what were the spiritual resources that he had. So he looked at that and he knew what he thought happened. For those of us who have not done that work, it's harder to face grief and loss. And what does it mean? You know, what does it mean when your child is murdered? What does it mean when your spouse loses their job? What does it mean when your relationship ends? All of that. If we haven't done the work personally and theologically, spiritually around grief, it's going to be a lot harder. That doesn't mean it goes away, but it means that we have more resources and resiliency to be able to look at this and deal with this.
So I find this whole discussion quite fascinating, Lisa. And I really appreciate the angle you're coming at this. These are really tender times when ministers are, when they have to end up going through a negotiated settlement with the congregation, with that separation. It's a very tender time for everyone. And to come at it from, and find that correlation of like grief being a part of that story is very interesting on like the front loading of that. I wouldn't have thought to do that. What I'm curious about and what I find really painful about this is the idea that the idea of the boundaries, right, the healthy boundaries, causing there to be some sense of separation in that relationship, meaning that you've got this minister going through a thing and necessarily not being able to share it in a deep way with the congregation. And then the congregation somehow misinterpreting what that is, what that distance, that sensing that distance is. You use that term sharks in the water, which I that's a really sharp image. That paints a very sharp image. And I'm curious what in your research and in your experience, what advice do you give to lay leaders who are on the other side of that relationship, right? Who, like, what can lay, as a lay leader myself, what can people like I do in congregations to kind of avoid that dynamic and pattern of that results in a negotiated settlement sometimes when this is happening to their minister without our knowledge, necessarily direct knowledge of how this is working out?
Right. Well, there's both the in the moment and the preventative. So in the moment, what can happen is one of the things I did just this last month was I went to a board meeting in a congregation where a minister has experienced some recent loss and where they are expecting to experience more, with parents dying, you know, and parents parents in law and serious stuff. And so I went to the board and I talked to them with them and said, here's what we've learned about how this impacts the minister and how the minister might be different. And here's what you as a board can do. You can let the congregation know this is the time to give the minister or religious educator or whomever some space and some slack. They will, you know, this, as you know, when you face grief, you know, there's that. And because this is such a relational job, it can be hard. So having the board or the committee on ministry speak to the congregation and say, here's what's going on, and we need to provide space for the minister to do this grieving, is all, you know, is a great thing to do at that time. The sort of sharks in the water comment is, there's all this stuff that goes around ministerial lore, which is all it takes is 17 people to get rid of a minister if they're committed. So, so that's sort of that image of people who, if there are the 17 there who want to get rid of the minister, of course, if you believe the minister is harming your congregation, you're going to want to do whatever you can to make that end. You might be the only 17, or you might be representative of the whole congregation. You know, but what the preventative work is to have good, robust conflict resolution policies in the congregation, to have done the work on covenant about what it means, to have a way to articulate and evaluate and talk about where is the congregation going? What are our goals? Is this minister taking us there? That back and forth that helps the congregation be in that deep relationship. I often say that our congregations are places that are countercultural because we're trying to figure out how do we say the hard things to each other and work through the hard things face to face, not through the freaking anonymous emails or the anonymous surveys or anything like that. So part of it is the congregation taking seriously their work to feel, what does it mean to live in deep connection with each other, knowing we're not always going to agree, knowing that the person sitting next to you might think the minister is the best one ever while you are thinking they're horrible, and how do we balance and live in all of that? So that's a preventative work. But the immediate work is giving the minister the space and time and being the ones to let the congregation know about the patterns to help shield the minister from some of that. I mean, for any of you who were at General Assembly this past year, when on the Sunday morning, we learned that two of the UUA staff had been beaten in the French Quarter the night before. And I, as UUA staff, had chosen not to learn about to deeply invest myself in the election about who would be the next president, because I didn't have a say and I didn't want to be disappointed and put that on the successor. Well, I can tell you, Susan Frederick Gray had me the moment sorry, this is still emotional, that morning when she talked about James and Tim being assaulted and then said, "You leave the staff alone. These are their friends. This is not just another thing that has happened." And her sense of protecting us and letting people know what was going on, it's sort of like, okay, Susan, whatever you ask me to do, whatever building, you know, to jump off of, you've got me. Because she understood the depth of that grief and that pain. And if our congregations and our lay leaders can do that for our religious professionals, it will help stave off a lot of the misunderstandings that can happen.
But it's interesting, Lisa, you point to earlier, you talked about instances where ministers were able to fiercely advocate for that space for staff people, but not for themselves. So it's interesting. I know that when the religious educator I work with lost both of her parents in the course of one church year, I said to her, I said, "You take whatever time you need to do whatever it is you need, and we'll figure it out, and I'll make that okay with the board of the congregation. I'm making that decision," right? Like, it was that clear. And the board and the lay leadership and the RE committee, they all respected that was the decision, because part of, you know, who we claim to be in the world, right?
Right.
What values that we want to operate from. But
that's the job, I think, of the UUA staff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those of us who are in congregational life or in the department, the ministry and professional leadership staff group, to be able to say to congregations, "Hey, this is an unusual thing. Here's what we know will help you all be a success. How can we do that?" I reach out to all the ministers I know who are having grief issues, but I don't know who all they are. But in my region, I reach out to them and I let them know, you know, can we help you line up other preachers? Do you know that there's money available from the sustentation funds so that you can go into therapy around grief and do things like that? Or if you need to go on a retreat, that there are funds available to help you. Another shock that happened with some, I talked to someone whose spouse had died and they had young children. And so they went immediately into having to be a single parent as well as helping their young people grieve. And that whole thing of how do you do that? You know, so how does the congregation help support with childcare when necessary? Or things like, you know, there's all these things that could happen or could help if we just stop a moment and think. And that's my job, is to help the congregations and the ministers stop and think about that, and to do it in consultation with the minister or religious professional, so that I'm not encouraging the congregation to do something that is uncomfortable for them. You know, I have one colleague who went and did laundry for somebody, but not everybody wants the congregation to see their literal dirty laundry, and that kind of stuff. So it's all of that that's involved with it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that if the congregation wanted to come and do my laundry, I'd say no. But if it were colleagues, that'd be a different calculation, right? I might let a colleague come over and do my laundry. Even, I mean, I'm not in that space, so it feels weird just to say that. But
well, right, you know, I had to move unexpectedly. I got the house I was renting immediately became unavailable. So I had to move unexpectedly. And so I invited the congregation to help me. Now, usually what I do when it's short move is I just will take a drawer out of a dresser, move the dresser, put the drawers back in. I packed all my freaking clothes because I couldn't just pack the underwear drawer. You know, I didn't care if they saw my socks, but I didn't want them to see that stuff. So I packed every piece of clothing so it wouldn't look like a bizarre anomaly. And they just thought I was weird. But, you know, that was just further proof of my being weird.
It's quite the metaphor for vulnerability, right? That we have to pack our own underwear drawer. I'm wondering regionally if you saw any differences. I'm really struck by this idea that having a colleague come is not always possible. It's not always easy. Let's put it that way. In some places, like in Mid-America, for example, you might be one of only, you know, 8 or 10 clergy in an entire state. Whereas out in Massachusetts or New Jersey, you know, you might have 15 clergy within 20 miles of you, clergy colleagues. So I'm just curious, in your research, did you see any regional differences?
This study wasn't large enough. I only interviewed deeply about 20 people, but in that was a colleague from New England who was dismayed that their colleagues knew that there was this loss and no one ever called and no one ever asked after how they were doing. And this was someone who, this is someone who people would have known this had happened. You know, they're not somebody who would have expected people to read their mind and know there was a loss. The colleagues did. And so there was this sense of loss and betrayal to them of losing their colleagues because their colleagues didn't step up in any fashion, and it, even though they were close. And so a lot of it depends on the flavor of the minister's chapter. How much are you in each other's business? How much are you, how do you support each other? How busy do we make ourselves? So it was really interesting. And yeah, in some places, it's not going to be possible for someone to come do the laundry, but it doesn't mean somebody can't get on a Google Hangout or a Zoom to just say, how the heck are you doing? Or, you know, if, I mean, chapters could do things like take up, if they can't be there to do the laundry, they could take up a collection for, you know, cleaning people to come in and out, you know, that, I mean, there's so many different ways that we can support each other that it's really important. And it's, you know, I mean, the chapters also differ of what did they do during sabbatical coverage. One of the chapters I've been in, they, you know, the colleagues will provide up to half of the services for a minister on sabbatical at no charge to the congregation. In others, that process doesn't exist. So it's part of the, it might be cultural in that sense, but I didn't see geography necessarily being the defining factor.
And, you know, especially in this era of technology, you know, when my kid was really sick as a young child, you know, briefly, thankfully, I had a colleague call a local restaurant and order dinner for my family delivered, knowing that I did not have time to prepare food and asking me in advance if that would be okay. And it was just such a wonderful, caring thing. And this was a colleague who lived halfway across the country. This was not someone locally. They went online and researched local restaurants that would deliver and ordered me dinner. And it was just, you know, the pastor parents group have sent each other gift cards and things when we know that we're someone in the group is struggling. You know, just say like, don't worry about dinner. Like, here's a gift card to order takeout from, which is usually a luxury. And there are things that we can do for one another that don't depend on geographical proximity. Doing the laundry does.
Well, it's the kind of stuff that hopefully the congregation is doing for other people who are grieving, who are in the congregation. So it's finding our own congregation to support us, you know? I've been thinking about cultural differences, not only in how we grieve, but in who we grieve. For instance, I know people from cultures where many people are called uncle or aunt. And so they're like, my aunt died, my uncle died. And I've been in work environments where other people not of that culture say, for Christ's sake, how many aunts and uncles can they have? They're always skipping work. And and so I think about, this is complicated stuff, right? Because in some cultures, family is a very bigger thing than the nuclear family, which we're kind of given permission to grieve. And I think about this as a single minister that, you know, if somebody's spouse dies, of course it's terrible, but if somebody's best friend dies, you know, if you're single, that best friend may fill a lot of the same roles that someone else's spouse does. So there are just complications about it that really demand listening to each other and respecting each other's complex lives. And it makes me think about how, you know, in a New England culture, which, I mean, this is a very broad brush, so forgive me, New England people, for whom this doesn't fit, but that kind of stiff upper lip, you know, we can do it, you can make it on your own. I mean, I noticed once I broke my leg in the days when I worked at the UUA in Boston, and UUs, if I asked for anything, would give it to me, but they would never say, would you like that every week? Whereas at the time I was in a CPE with Catholics, and they really got like, oh, let me help you, not just now when you ask, but A, let me ask you, and B, let me offer it to you constantly. And it just made me see what kind of a, you know, really Protestant, waspy, upper class culture New England, and I'm not, I know some of our congregations have really broken this culture, I really do, but just that's a very predominant feeling in New England, which is different. And Minnesota is a very clannish culture. So you help your own clan, you'll do anything for them. And once somebody's in your clan, they are in for life. But I know from people who move here, especially when they're older, that getting into somebody's clan is incredibly hard here. And so, you know, I moved back, but I had friends from young adulthood, so they took me right back in. But I know other colleagues who have moved here, you know, colleagues have been their only friends because the culture at large is harder to break into. All of that is to say that we're all operating in multiple contexts, and that, you know, I've known some of the negotiated settlements around people of color to have involved recent significant losses and grief. And I think that there are probably some real differences there in how that plays out and the permission given to really to the ability to be vulnerable and be treated well, just, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was a long ramble, but I've just been thinking about that as I've been listening.
Right. Well, in my study, I didn't define what grief was. So I had people whose grief was, yes, the death of someone. It was divorces. And that someone, even Meg, going to your point, even for one person who has a very good committed relationship with their spouse, it was the death of a best friend that totally undid them. So it's not just if you're single, but it can be, you know, yeah. But so it was deaths. It was, as I said, miscarriage, death of a pet. There was some who, someone who's, now for me, geography doesn't resonate that deeply necessarily. I could be almost anywhere, but there are some people who feel so deeply rooted in a place, in a community, and it was destruction that happened in that community that they had to grieve and grieved for years. And it reminded me recently, I was visiting someone in the hospital here in my city, and I'm new in this city, so I haven't, you know, this is my first hospital visitation. And I was just looking at the literature that the hospital provides. First of all, they have very generous visiting hours. It's from 8 in the morning until 10 at night. And then it says, except for family members / support persons. And then it says, we rely upon you to define who those people are. So, and this is a Methodist hospital, I think, in its affiliation. And so, yes, it's that you get to define this loss and how much it is. And then, you know, getting to the negotiated terminations and resignations, in that, I've long held that what is often broken in that's hardest are the dreams about what this ministry would be, about how this relationship would be, about all of that. And so both the minister and the congregation are suffering broken dreams. Yet sometimes it does get disproportionately visited upon the clergy, especially on our clergy who are from historically marginalized communities, you know, especially ones that that haven't yet quite made it to the mainstream. I remember when I was studying for ministry back in the 80s, I could count on two hands with fingers left over the number of out lesbian and gay ministers. Now it's ho-hum in many of our congregations, or at least to a certain degree ho-hum, but there are other people, bi's, trans, you know, people of color. There were the same number of African-American clergy back then as there were out gay and lesbian. And so the fact that we have succeeded in welcoming one outside group and not any other outside group, you know, it says lots about us. And it says where this is going to be even disproportionately harder for our colleagues and friends. One of the things too that people talked about, a number of the people talked to me about their coping mechanisms and how they wish somebody had sort of taken them aside and said, are you really sure this is the way you want to deal with this grief? Because there are people who abused food or alcohol or drugs to the point where they weren't able to function. There were, these were only men who admitted to this part where they became sexually active in ways that they later regretted. And felt that it was a way to try to escape their grief rather than to actually look at it and think. So it was really interesting to see how people could articulate, not in the moment, but afterwards, how they had not chosen well for themselves in that grief time.
I also wonder, and you know, this, you're right, somebody should pick this up as a DMN, because I wonder how their next ministries go. Because I think profound grief for me opened up a whole lot of spiritual territory I'd never been in and made me a better minister, more compassionate, more respectful of other people's vulnerability and strength. And so while I can see that it would immediately be seen as a really negative effect, it could also ultimately, you know, given that there is a next time and that there's the ability to go on, because I think what Lori said about the grief involved in the negotiated settlement itself, I've observed a few times, not as systematically as you have, but just that grief and the grief of whatever else happened kind of merged together in a big grief pot, and it gets harder to come back from that.
Yeah, I think it depends whether or not you allow the grief to or if the grief, depending on how it is, it's not necessarily conscious or and not necessarily under your control, but whether it breaks you open or just breaks you. And in the breaking open of the self to understanding the depth of grief and what that means, it does make people, I think, more compassionate, better ministers when they can be in touch with that. Sometimes, though, it is just so horrific, all it does is break you, and you can't go back into that realm. You simply can't, because it is too costly. So and the ministers usually said, for those who are suffering the same kind of grief they were, even during the intense part of their grief, they felt more deeply connected and better able to respond to them. There's also someone who said that they had lost, you know, their grief happened just about a week before September 11th disasters in our country. And they were in a New York area congregation. So they had to shelve their grief to help the congregation deal with that. And it took years for them to be able then to go back to the point where they could break open that grief in themselves and not just carry it with them.
One of the things that I actually was in a congregation, as Lisa knows, that did go through a negotiated settlement with a minister. And I'll tell you, it took me years. I mean, in the aftermath of that broken dreams thing that you're talking about, mm-hmm. working through my own grief around everything that happened in that and everything that I did and didn't do in that. And I'll tell you, the broken dreams are real, and they're real for not only the clergy, but also the
absolutely
parishioners. And one profound thing that you said about whether it breaks you open or breaks you, that resonated with me so deeply, because I had a good friend say to me, who was unaffiliated with was not a Unitarian Universalist, but she said, look, this grief you're suffering and you're living with is, you know, rather than, she helped me reimagine it in such a way where I was able to see it as a, rather than putting a hole in my heart, it was scooping my heart out so that in the future it was a bigger container to hold more. And that image, I just would meditate on that image, like this pain I'm feeling in my heart is actually creating a bigger space for future.
That's a lovely image.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Joanna Macy, the heart that breaks open can contain the world. Yeah. Well, that is a nice note to close on. Lisa, is there anything you haven't gotten to say that you hoped to?
No, I think I've said it, and anybody who wants a copy of this report can get in touch with me. The easiest way is through my email, which is lpresley, L-P-R-E-S-L-E-Y, at uua.org.
Great. Thank you. And Lori can put that out on our Facebook group as well. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for the honor of being with you all today.
Take care.
This has been an episode of The View. If you would like to learn more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.